Tonight's talk is on time, from time to the timeless. And it's a continuation of the series that I have been presenting on the continua of practice. And what I try to do within this series is present the part of the continuum as where we all start within the frame of our own reference, with a strong sense of self-centeredness and disposition to follow our internal patterns and conditioning, our perceptions of distance and separation from each other, and the sense of an inward time where we're kind of being oppressed by a past which we once had. And then there is often a hope for a clearer and brighter future up ahead of us. And we all have that sort of frame of reference for our lives when we begin meditation. And much of the early part of our meditation has to do with the adaptation response within that particular frame of reference. So we try to change our thoughts to be better thoughts. We try to adjust our lives to be more adaptable to the circumstances. We try to open our heart and practice certain qualities that allow us to be more benevolent and compassionate. And we undertake a rather strenuous meditation practice that we think will help us be able to see what we have to adapt to, what we have to change, what we need to do to move ourselves forward with a little more less contention in the world and a little more ease within ourselves. So tonight I want to talk about that journey in terms of time, in terms of the timeless. And I just picked different topics, but really the topic is they're transferable. If you might not have noticed, you hopefully will, because one of the points I'm trying to make is that as I pick these different froms and twos, that really you could almost interchange them with the different talks because they come out to be equivalencies. And as I get into the talk, I think you'll see what I mean by that. But let me begin with a fact of time. I love this subject. I was excited last year to know that it was the 100th anniversary of Einstein's general relativity, in which he sort of turns time upside down. And so, just to acquaint myself a little bit, I've studied some of that in the past, and Einstein saw a time not as a standalone, but as an accompanying part of space, that it was, you couldn't separate the two. In fact, he called time and space, space-time, space/time. And some of the science of today says there's no scientific reason that time should go forward, that we just happen to be in a particular set of physical characteristics on this plane of existence in which time does move forward. But there's no reason scientifically that it should move from future to past. That's weird, isn't it? So I'm just going to present some weirdness. And so general relativity says that the faster you go, time slows down. And also the closer you get to massive objects, time slows down. So somebody on the second floor of your house is actually living slightly longer than you are on the first floor. Was that right? Yeah, the person on the second floor of a building is aging slightly faster than you are on the first floor. That's weird, isn't it? I like that because it turns, okay, so what, you see that? That's measurable time. That's with the scientific instruments tuned to their infinite degree. That's the way it looks to them. That's what their instruments are measuring. And it's deeply confusing to us because we don't feel that. We don't feel that it could go backwards. It just can go forward. I mean, how can it go backward? This goes forward. And so this external way that time is being understood is extremely strange. But it's actually not any stranger than how our internal response is governed, which I'd like to spend a little time speaking about. How we relate to time internally is equally, if not more strange than that. And this is something that we can get our hands around, because most of us in meditation who have experienced meditation to some degree have some sense that time isn't really a truth. It is something that's carried by our thinking, but it's actually not in front of us. It's never something that we can participate in except through the intermediary of thought. If we want to know how time flows within us, we have to go to our thinking, because our thinking seems to hold the image of what we have been with all the ideas of what we were. It's not really here, is it? And what we will be, all the thoughts and expectations and anticipations of where time may be going. But it's not really here. And so when you start living more central to where life is actually arising, time becomes very confusing. In fact, I would like, instead of calling it space-time, I would like to call it tonight thought-time. So then when we get a sense that the time that we experience as a human being really depends upon ourselves thinking our way through that, that's a sobering idea. That's very, very sobering to us. Now, most of us don't live that truth. We sense it, and many of us have realized it at a deep level, but few of us actually live it. Now, why is that, you see? If you realize that time was carried by our thinking, and thinking is just a movement of neurological movement of conditioning within ourselves, thoughts are just neurons firing, and all of the impetus and truth that we give to our past, having to work out our past, and the stressors that we are under, and all the ways that we use time to, in the pressures of time, pushing us forward, and all of the expectations we have for our life going forth, and all of that is contained within our thought time, within our thinking, well, you could see that a tremendous burden could be removed from our lives by simply living the fact of that truth, by being able to perceive the thought as a thought rather than as time. Because as we practice and mature in our practice, we begin to experience the ability to hear ourselves think. Much as you hear me speak, you will at some point, if you haven't already, be able to actually hear yourself think. The awareness, which is really the immediacy of your life, the awareness hears thoughts passing through it. And you become convinced, you don't become convinced, you just see it. Oh, this is just content of the present. This is just content that's passing through the present and is carrying a particular message about time. It's not time. In fact, when I looked up the definition of time, no one really has a very good definition of what time is, not even the scientists. The best they can do is to say it's the passage of events. F- Fair enough, it's the passage of events. But it's carried within our ability to think where we've been or where we need to go, which are abstractions to the present moment. Just get this into your head. Yeah. So why is it, given that fact, and given the turbulence and difficulty with which we live with that fact, and the oppression that that fact gives most of our lives, why don't we live in accordance to the truth of that and release ourselves from the need to be time bound? Because there's a tyranny of time that I'll get to in a moment. Once you're bound in time, you're bound within a particular perspective of the world. That's why we don't let go of our thinking. Because to let go of our thinking is much more than just simply releasing ourselves from disturbing thoughts about the future or burdensome thoughts about the past. When we step out of that dimension of ourselves, we also step out of ourselves. Because what's carried within the past of what I've been and the future of what I will be is the image of ourself that we cherish beyond all other thoughts. And to let go of time is to let go of that cherished image. And so we'll hold on to time even though we've seen it, because it's too disturbing to us to step completely out of the problem. We want to remain who we are for some more time. And so we will continue to live within this oppressive field of distance, because distance is time. Time to cover the distance. So distance is also thought created. The sense of I only gets its perspective having known ourselves before. Who we've been, the certainty of our past, carried within the immediate reflection of our image. Just stand in front of the mirror and you know where you've been. You know who you are. You know everything about you. And the sense of that sense of trauma that most of us have carried from our past gives us a hope or possibility of how a future could be better than it is now. And that hope invites more thinking about time. But in the reflection itself of the mirror, what do we see? In fact, that is an exercise I used to give quite often, but nobody ever did it, because I think it was, well, at least not very many people did it, because I think it was too upsetting to stand in front of a mirror and see what the image reflects, then see what you bring to that image. So you can try it, do it for 5 minutes, and just see, that's the actual reflection of the present. The reflection of the mirror is what is actually occurring. Now everything else that you know about that image, you're bringing from your past concept, your past formation, your past idea of yourself. It's not contained in the actual reflection, it's contained in your thoughts about the reflection. And you get very one-dimensional, which is interesting. One-dimensional doesn't mean like a piece of paper, it means that the sense of past and future become transparent, and you just see the image. And that's the doorway, through time. That's the doorway that we can use to step out of the tyranny of time. Because I want to talk a little bit about the tyranny of time. And I kind of awoke to it when I had decided I was going to retire, phase in a retirement. Because retirement and meditation have the same kind of outcome. That is, to have less doing, to not be governed by the pressures of time, to come to some understanding of a relationship with time. I mean, retirement, which few people seem to be successful in, is really a stepping out of the busyness of one's life, the productive phase of one's life. And although you may have lined up, we may have lined up a number of activities to do in retirement, the great benefit of retirement is stepping out of the pressured, tension-filled life in which time was the essential component that pushed us on. But meditation is supposed to do that same thing. But what I've begun to see in myself, as well as others, is that we weren't really working with time. We were victims of time. We weren't observers of time. We weren't stepping out of time and seeing what it was doing to us. We were encapsulated and pushed by time. And until we are willing to really look at some of the ways that time is held within our conditioning, we won't feel the bite of time sufficiently to want to step out. So you take a simple activity like brushing your teeth, and you begin to just notice the bearing of time upon that simple activity. Take any activity and watch the oppressive quality of time as it drives that you forward through that activity with a stress, with a tension associated. There's a whole way that we speak to ourselves when we're engaged in an activity that is central to time's theme. And it won't allow you to settle in to the present. It keeps you from actually being present, because being present and time are in separate paradigms. Time says, look ahead. This activity you're doing is an interim step to something more important that you're about to do. So in the beginning class, I give them an assignment to do a marker, which if everyone has gone through a beginning class, many of you know, and it's doing that one activity like brushing your hair or brushing your teeth or eating a meal, and which the point is to show you how difficult it is to do one thing with full body and mind. Because the terror of time comes in to rob us of being settled within any activity. You see, why is that? Because we have to again understand, why is it that we have become subservient to that tyranny? It's because it carries us along with it. If we were to stop, like just seeing the reflection in the mirror, in exactly the same way, if we just stop with any activity like brushing our teeth, suddenly we would sense the meaninglessness of everything we do, is one way of saying it. Because what's the point? The point has always been to get over this so that I can do the next thing. The activity itself was never the point. You see? It was the interim step to some time when we would have and reach the point. But that never comes. We just continue to lace together points. And so we never completely rest at any given point, because to do so would show us a kind of meaninglessness in how we were living. It would interrupt the continuity of time, in which that is where we get our meaning. That is where we get our purpose. That is where we get everything that we hold the world to be. So my suggestion to all of you is to turn your practice towards time. Start seeing what it actually does to you. The tensions of the body, the demands it places upon us. It's like this overriding voice, the master of ceremonies. And it determines the state of our well-being or not. The tyranny of time. Thought time. I want to keep those two linked, because as we keep them linked, it gives us a reasonable perspective on the problem. If you just say time, it feels too amorphous. If you keep it contained within thought, it's something that we can deal with. That we now can actually stand up to and observe, as opposed to just the passage of events. That's too amorphous. It's too... So I've listed a few things that I just want to talk about the tyranny of time and how it relates to meditation. The first thing that it does when we live within the frame of reference of time in meditation, remembering that the point of meditation is to take us out of that disturbance of time. It's to cut our dependency on time. But for much of our meditation, we just feed that dependency. Is the practice of becoming, right? I want to become something with my practice. And there's nothing wrong with it. I'm not scolding anyone. I'm just showing how it lays itself out for almost everyone as we take up a practice. We take up a practice within the frame reference of time. And so we're going to use the practice, not for its intended purpose, which is to step out of that dependency, but to force ourselves forward within the same frame of reference. So I want to become something with my practice. Becoming something has a very obvious link to the thought of future, does it not? I want to become something different than I am now. And that way of thinking really controls much of our meditation. We're always sitting and evaluating ourselves in relationship to how we're responding to the need to become different. Am I relaxed enough? Am I calm enough? Do I have enough focus? Am I nicer now than I used to? We want very clear mile markers that show us that all the work we're doing in time has its point. But meditation is not about the continuation of giving substantiality to thought. It's not about thought making. It's not about crediting thought. It's not an accreditation of the way I think. It's to look and to see what the way I'm thinking is doing to me. It takes the process, the what it is that has led our lives to be like this, and shows us what has forced us into the mold that we currently are. It doesn't take us to make and rearrange that molding into a new configuration. That's the becoming. It lets the realization of what we're doing reform itself, you might say. And we bring that sense of, oh, I should be further along than this. Well, where am I in this practice? I want to, if I'm doing this continuum stuff, where am I in this? I want a marker, you know, it's like, you know, I want to know on Candyland or one of the, where is my little red figure? I'm here now. Is there a way I can slip past some of this? Another limitation of time, I'm having to go fairly quickly through some of these, but I hope to engage you in a way that allows for your own curiosity to take over and investigate some of these more thoroughly. Let me just stop there for a moment, though. Instead of this pressured feeling of needing to be somewhere else in practice, I would suggest a different way of thinking about practice rather than what you're going to become out of it. How is it nourishing you now? How is your practice nourishing you? To ask that question cuts time. It cuts that oppression of you never being good enough. How is it nourishing me now? And to do that, you have to be still and look and feel whether the quiet is nurturing, whether you can rearrange the way you look upon whatever it is that's happening, the content of your life, the emotions you're having, from nourishment rather than from depletion and discontentedness. How can I look upon myself now in a nourishing way? So take that at heart, if you would, and cut yourself from this tyranny that many of us force right along with us through our meditation. You can see that this is an important talk in that sense. So another way that time infringes upon our contentment is that it doesn't allow us, thought time doesn't allow us to have a center. It doesn't allow me to know where I'm standing. It doesn't give me a location because thoughts don't locate. Thoughts are abstract locations. They're about where you've been and where you will be. They don't give you a firm place here and now. And so as long as we're time bound, we won't have a place to be able to center. We won't have the coordinates of our location. And if we don't think that's important, you really haven't understood meditation. It starts with that. An embodied experience. That's why we keep referencing the body, because the body has a reference. It has a location. And so to give ourselves over to time is to lose the very way that the meditation is encouraging us towards a settled approach to life. Let alone the pressures that meditation gives us, or that thought gives us when we, you know, there, something's left undone. You know, I know there's something, I can feel it. You know, this, I'm not settled. I'm feeling very agitated. I feel restless. I feel perturbed. I feel annoyed. Here's one. I feel impatient. With what? With time. It's not going the way I want it to. I'm bored. You see all the references to time? I'm not getting what I want here. This moment isn't worth paying attention to. I'm bored. It establishes only a reference in which I can show up for this moment because, my God, it's very pleasant. Now, the next time I sit down, I want to have that come back again. I want to reestablish that sense of contentment. And so I'll try very hard to go back to that place. Okay, so I'm going to continue forward here. We use time to solve our problems. How do we do that? We do that instantaneously. Because when something we feel is amiss, we anticipate, expect something better to be occurring soon. And so we never really look at the problem as the challenge in front of us. We try to fix it through an expectation of this changing into something more manageable in the future. And that anticipation keeps our eye from actually meeting the resolution of the problem, which is not trying to change it into something else in the future, but seeing for what it is now. So all of these fast, speed of light, conditioned response, suddenly, we're sitting with an itch, intolerable. I want a meditation in which I don't have a lot of stuff going on. I just want to be quiet. Well, I need to do something. Nobody's looking. I'll scratch the damn itch. I'll change the posture. I'll do whatever I feel is necessary for me to get over this oppression of time. It's the time that's oppressive. It's not the itch. We have brought the problem to bear upon us by conceiving a reality that we expect to happen that doesn't contain the itch. And therefore, when the itch persists, that's our problem. A persisting itch. When we expect it to end. Moving along here. Here's one. I didn't pick easy ones for you, by the way. Many of us have a sense that our practice should go through a whole set of experiences. That we should, if we're going to feel as if this thing is working to our advantage over time, then we should have certain experiences that I hear the more senior meditation practitioners talk about. Feelings of emptiness or being not identified with aspects of our mind, or a sense of quietude and calm, or an opening heart. And so I'm going to wait patiently. I'll put in my time on the pillow until these experiences arise. And then that will confirm that my meditation is progressing. Meditative experiences. And so that's consenting our life to a future orientation when I can be validated through an experience. But validation doesn't come through an experience. It comes through presence. It comes through the release of time. And so as long as we're in anticipation of an experience validating our meditation, we can be assured that it won't. You see how we use time? It's a whole frame of reference. It's a whole way of thinking. It's a whole way of seeing and perceiving. And all of the logic that we place upon ourselves and the world is time-based. And we dress problems through time. This problem I need to resolve by doing such and such, maybe skirting the issue, maybe denying that it's there, whatever it takes. But not settling. Because as soon as we settle, we are in a different dimension than the stress-related activity of time. And yet meditation, which is just seeing, that's what meditation is, just seeing what's there. Notice that the seeing doesn't have time. It doesn't matter what it sees. It's not waiting to see something. If it was waiting to see something, then it would be time-bound. It just sees. So the seeing is outside of time. If we're willing just to see, without expectation of the what I see changing into a different experience, or resulting from a previous experience of hopefully getting back something that I used to see, if we just see, everything is settled out because we also see time. When we're really seeing, the seeing is big enough to catch the thoughts that hold the time. But the trick is that we are so linked up to every perception in terms of the time associated with it, usually the past, and may I say especially emotion. When an emotion arises, there's such a conditioned reference to that emotion. We have had all the emotions our whole life, and so every one of them carries a sequencing of what we were like when we had that emotion the last time or at age two. And so it carries a bundled history with it. I mean, it doesn't take much. If I just said a few words like grief, anger, you see, it doesn't, immediately you're thrown back into your past where those emotions arose within the dimension of a particular circumstance. When we're sitting and an emotion arises, time is so invested within the emotion that we lose ourselves almost completely within that emotional history. We lose ourselves into the past, almost within every perception, but certainly within every emotional perception. Emotions in some ways carry a link of tragedy and or uplift that has a dynamic that is very difficult to sense the time associated with it. But if we can bring the emotion into the present as it's occurring, rather than falling enslaved to the past of the emotion, like grief, suddenly grief is like all the griefs, you know, the dog I lost and my neighbor next door, and and then now it's like, But if we can be present to the response as it's arising, to the emotion in the present, so that we're not carried away by the past. It's not that the emotion isn't going to bear the footprint or the fingerprint of the past. It will. But if we lose ourselves within that, then we have no center. We have no place to stand. We have no reality, really, in front of us. So to bring attention to emotions and let them bear whatever they bear, but to do so within the framework of the present is essential. Or else it will just recondition itself going forward into the same pattern that we have lived with. I call that the past living within the present. The past can live within the past. That's when we don't have any perspective of time. We're being timed. But we have no perspective of time. And there's the past that lives within the present, in which we have a perspective of what is going on so that we don't lose our footing within that. Remembering that all of the fixation, all of the ways that we lose our footing, reaffirms the sense of me. The more I fall back into the sways of my history, the more I know I was there then, and therefore validates me being here now. If I lived then I must also live now. And so many of us don't want to stop or disrupt time, as I mentioned early on in this talk. We like to lose our footing. It allows the journey to have a nobility about us, because look where we've been, for God's sake. And then we try to work out the past so that that nobility can be honored. Can you imagine trying to work out thought? How are we going to work out thought? See, it doesn't have any bearing. It's in the history books. It's done. It's over. No matter what you do, it reads the same. Page 10. It reads the same. How we work ourselves out of the past is in the present. Now, the mechanism to all of this is the very quick response of wanting and fearing, wanting and fearing, wanting and fearing. And as we look across the landscape of our lives or a situation or a present moment experience, you'll feel the flashes of wanting and fearing, wanting and fearing. And as soon as we buy in to that flash of wanting or fearing, we've lost ourselves within what wanting and fearing does, which is giving ourselves over to the thought of time. I want this. It's not here yet, but I want it. I'm afraid of that. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm afraid it will. Once that mechanism gets going, then we are lost on that particular, in that particular orientation. Our whole orientation to life will then be wanting and fearing. That's what the Buddha talked about as the second noble truth. But the question we're asking tonight is, can we come to the end of time? when we realize that neither time nor experience will transform us. No matter what experience we have, experience does not transform us. Seeing transforms us. Seeing the experience, seeing the thought of time, and seeing always comes from now. It never comes from any other location. It's an active verb, expressing itself only in the present, never having any other relationship, except it can see other relationships. It can see past thoughts. It can see future expectations. But it itself does not get lost in that. It just sees them, like we're seeing the room of people. I was trying to think of an analogy, and I couldn't remember. It's like water. You start making soup, but you have water, right? So water is sort of the basis of soup. Then you dump in your everything, all your vegetables and your broth and your... But the water holds all of that, right? Everything in there is of the water. This is very poor. It's the best I can do. And you can take out the vegetables, you still have the water. And the water holds it all. So there is a seeing. Let's just get back to the seeing holds it all. Now, I wanted to mention the counter influence. The counter influence is that point when we realize we cannot move any further in our spiritual journey until we come to the end of time. That's a very sobering acknowledgement for many of us, that we can't move ahead because all we're doing are using the tools of time in order to move forward, and the tools of time just perpetuates the concept and thought of time. And at some point we say, okay, I can't do this. I can't keep thinking time-related experiences. And the false nirvana in that place where we love to settle, many of us are masters of time. We are masters of time. It's called efficiency experts. We're masters of how to work the world in terms of time so that it works in accordance. And all of us have some degree of ability in that area. And we're reluctant to give that up. It's like, you know, that's our skill base, really. And time holds all of everything I know. It holds everything I know. How would I know something except that I learned about it at a different time and I brought it forward in memory? So that recognition that's in the moment has come from a past association. That's how I know something. So if I'm going to step out of time, it means that I'm going to be without knowledge? Does it mean that I'm going to be without the very abilities and skills that I've counted on my whole life? Let me reassure you, it does not. You still have access to your knowledge. You still have access to time. You still know the bus is going to be in 20 minutes. It's the oppression of time, the tyranny of time that we step out of. We step out of the tyranny of time. Into quiet, where thoughts are seen but not invested in. And then everything changes. Nothing is missed. We still can stand in front of the mirror and know who that reflection is. We don't go, now what's his name? Thank you. Can we be quiet for a moment or two? So how do you sit? How do we sit? Mulling over our thinking, each thought, not just a thought about the future, but each thought contains the future or contains the past. How would you know what it is that you recognize within the thought? Because it also has a memory component with each recognizable word. And here's the most recognizable thought of all. I. Feel the past within that thought. Specifically, it's not a thought of time. The I holds time. And so when we hear the thought of I, we're already enmeshed in time. Now, since the seeing, S-E-E-I-N-G, the seeing, that knows that that thought is arising, but doesn't invest in it. Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to answer. Right.
So just the idea that it would open up to actual experience being seen and
right.
Learn from hopefully integrated is exciting.
It is exciting, and the comment had to do with being able to understand that lying on the beach and just letting yourself drift thought is not the freedom that meditation is pointing to. But rather to have the context of what is occurring within the mind so that we're not being driven by that content as it's arising is a different ground of freedom. And it's not missing anything. It's not missing anything that was important to you is not missed. We think it's going to be missed because how can you step out of time and not kind of be befuddled and confused and walk into things but it doesn't happen, believe me. The sense of time is so enmeshed in the world of our perceptions that even though there can be this incredible stillness in the thick of it all, there also is the ability to navigate between objects and to recognize the functional utility of the need to know what time it is. What you miss is the oppression. And we're not going to miss it until we recognize that we have it. You can't just listen to a talk and say, yeah, I'm going to fix that. You got to, is in all of Buddhism. You have to see the gut of the problem, which is why I'm sending you into yourself, using time objectively, seeing what it does to you. When you're brushing your teeth, when you're trying to do any single act just for itself, when you're listening to somebody and there's a competing something, virtually in every moment in which we can truly rest, we find some way to compete against that rest, because the rest doesn't substantiate us. The competition, the movement substantiates us. So we have to battle, and I don't mean that in a ferocious sense, but we have to be aware of the impeding conflicts when we start looking at something as substantial as time. It's not an incidental. It's at the heart of who we are and claim to be. It's every bit as important as the sense of self. Why? Because it is the sense of self. Now you can see the substitution that comes in here. Just pick out the sense of self, put in time. You got the same equation going forward or backward. How do you know who you are? Just ask that basic question. How do I know who I am? I can tell you who I am because I can list off all the things, my characteristics, my blah, 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 all of which I've known because I've lived with myself all this time. So what if you lived with yourself free of that knowledge? That's where I send you to your mirror. Now, we could stay at the first part of this continuum, and we could spend generations, really, because there's an endless frolic in time. I mean, you're never good enough. You've never improved sufficiently. The person next to you has been sitting half as long, and look at their insights compared to your own. You want to play that game? Be my guest. It's just, I'm not going to play it with you. That's the only thing I can offer you, is a deeper truth than that suffering. There's a way to get out of this thing. There's a way to transcend it. There's a way to step out of it. Other questions or comments? Yes.
How does this framework coexist with the world where we do have goals set out and expectations where we do have to meet deadlines or improvements and consequences when things don't happen at a certain time?
So how does what I say tonight work with the functionality of the worlds of goals and expectations and work projects and all of that, right? Okay, so it doesn't, okay. Being embedded in time actually works against your greater efficiency. It actually does. It works. It doesn't help. We think it helps because that's the only thing we've ever used to get ourselves going, you know, in the morning. Get up. You know, you have a meeting today. Oh, okay. Oh, I don't want to get up. But there's a greater, once we remove that frame of reference, there's a greater motivation that each of us have that aliveness itself generates. Okay, so one, for instance, did you come drive here today? Okay. So when it's over, you have to find your way back to the car, right? Now you don't have to think every step of the way, where's my car? I've got, is it, okay, I have to take a step to the right, now I have to take a step forward. I have to open this door. Okay, you don't have to do that, do you? You just let it go and you walk to your car. Kind of effortless. It doesn't really require a lot of tension between you and the goal, does it? And you're just going there because that's the correct thing to do at this particular time in the evening, is to go to your car. You're not, there's no pressure on you to get there, and yet you find your way there very well. So too, if we had work projects that we needed to do, we would walk towards them with much more efficiency than we do as if we're pressured and oppressed by that. Because what happens, and I was meant to say this tonight, is that any kind of oppression that we have with time is because we have a residual pain body in us, because we don't think we're good enough to do it unless we pressure ourselves, or we think we're too lazy, or we remember the time in third grade when, you know, we're scolded because we didn't have our project in. All of these memories come back in, which create the sense of internal pressure that is our pain body that we carry with us in life. That's all driven by time. That's all the hookup of our emotional ambivalence and time, the history of time within that emotion. Okay, so would it be, I mean, if I have a job, I want to get paid. Payment is obvious. I know what I need to do. Hopefully I'm interested in what I'm doing. That's all I need. Life springs forth within that and does what it does most effectively and most efficiently. Even if you're a journalist and you're under some timeline to get your story in, try it. Just try it. Say, I'm going to put all this aside. I'm not going to be pressured by time. Am I interested in the work? Okay, I am. If I'm not interested in the work, then I have to find some other motivated reason to get myself going here. But I'm not going to pressure myself. The pressure never comes from the boss. The pressure always comes from me projected onto the boss. He's making me, it's not he's making anything. I'm making myself. Okay, let me just release my need. Now let me see the point of what I'm doing and let there be some self-motivation here in carrying myself forward. See, we think we need the boss. If the boss weren't pressuring us, we wouldn't do a good job or we would be lazy. That's the poor self-image that follows us, and we kind of whip ourselves into shape through the use of time. I would question our need to do that. Last question, if anyone has one. Yes.
It's not really a question, but your whole talk tonight really made me think about the other day and what I've heard in all of my practice is just see what's there, don't add all the junk on top. And so I was late and I was driving fast and I was in a car that was big for Seattle and I was driving around and I was like, okay, you're just late. That's all you want.
Right, right.
And I felt what you were talking about.
Right, beautiful. Yeah.
Just
late. That's right. That's what the mirror is showing, right? That's not, you don't have to, that's it. You didn't have to have all that stuff to get here quicker. It just made you miserable being late. Do we remember that meditation is supposed to not make us miserable? Do we remember that? There's a hook up there. Oh, this is supposed to be the end of suffering. I got it. Now, let me say something. It's very helpful to come to the discussions on the opposite weeks, because that extra week of intention and tending and looking, especially with a subject like time or, well, any of the subjects really, because they all contain the same level of depth if we're willing to go there, it gets flushed out in a different way. We change the style so you're not passive, but you're more active. That allows a different expression of the subject to come up in you. So I pair the talks with discussions for a particular reason, because it changes the perception, changes the dynamics of how the subject is related to. Just remember that when you think next week, oh, it's not a talk. Anyway, it's raining and there's traffic. And I'm going to be late. Thank you. Okay, so we have just a few announcements. Can we...